we're still getting to the bottom of it. We're considering this to be, you know, a huge training issue for us.
Primary election ballot problems in District 40 put race results in question. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 19th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a vice admiral committed to improving health care for the Department of Defense.
I really believe that the people who serve in uniform and the families who make sure that those of us in uniform can serve deserve to be at the top of their game all the time.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
The result of Tuesday's Democratic primary for House District 40 remains in doubt. And now there are also concerns over how voters in the Northwest Arctic village of Shungnak were able to cast ballots in both the Republican primary and in the primary for Democrats and others. According to Alaska Dispatch News, Shungnak Precinct Chairwoman Evelyn Woods says she mistakenly allowed 52 voters to cast ballots in both primaries. Dean Westlake is ahead of Benjamin Nagiak by 5 votes in the district, which covers the North Slope and Northwest Arctic boroughs, as well as 3 precincts in the unorganized borough. Election officials continue to count absentee ballots and will review question ballots. State Division of Elections Director Josie Banke says a state review will examine the statewide results, particularly those in Shungnak.
We're still getting to the bottom of it. We're considering this to be, you know, a huge training issue for us going into the general, and, you know, one that we will address meaningfully and promptly.
Shungnak was one of 6 precincts in northern and western Alaska that didn't report their results until well into Wednesday, many hours after they were supposed to be reported under state election procedures. Banke noted no voter was allowed to vote twice in the Democratic primary. The number of Democratic voters was similar to previous primaries, but there were more than 4 times as many Republican voters. 48 Shungnak residents voted for Westlake, while only 2 voted for Nagiak. It could be several weeks before the winner in District 40 is clear. The postmark deadline for absentee ballots mailed before the election is August 26th, and the Division of Elections anticipates it will take another week to certify the results. There's a good chance there will be a recount, since the trailing candidate or group of voters in an election this close can request a recount paid for by the state. The recount request deadline is 5 days after the state review of the results. It's not clear when that review will take place. A helicopter from Air Station Sitka medevaced 2 wilderness guides from Sitka Bay Thursday afternoon after they were mauled by a brown bear while leading a hiking expedition. The guides are crew members aboard a 74-passenger cruise vessel, the Wilderness Explorer, which is operated by Uncruise Adventures. According to Christopher Austin, the rescue swimmer on the flight, the female guide, who was in her 30s, was leading a tour of 20 people along Sitka Creek Trail when the attack occurred.
The first tour guide was up front. She didn't have any bear spray or any protection from wildlife on her, but the guide that was in the back of the group did. And unfortunately, there was about 20 people in between them. When the attack happened, he ran up to the front. All the other people took off, but he ran up, sprayed the bear as it was mauling the first victim, and was able to get it off of her. And there were some wounds inflicted onto him that were rather minor, but after that, the bear took off.
Austin says it appears the bear was a sow protecting her cubs. The Coast Guard said the victim sustained multiple injuries and severe lacerations. They were transported to Mount Edgecombe Hospital in Sitka. Austin says, although the woman was not ambulatory, she was alert and able to describe her injuries to her rescuers. Today, a spokesperson with Uncruise Adventures told the AP the woman was flown to Harborview Medical Center in Seattle for further treatment. Sitco Bay is 30 miles north of Sitka. The weather on scene was 23-mile-per-hour winds. The Department of Defense is in the middle of a massive makeover in how it provides health care to soldiers and their families. The top official in charge of the new Defense Health Agency came to Alaska for her first visit. She spoke with Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes about how the military wants to provide care that's not only better, but smarter.
Inside a conference room at the hospital on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, Raquel Bono is warm and casual. So much so that her assistant slides her a note.
Oh, I'm reminded to tell you that I'm a vice admiral.
That's the Navy's equivalent of a lieutenant general, which puts Admiral Bono right beside Alaska's most senior military commander. But you'd never know that by her disarming manner and eagerness to talk about how the military is changing its healthcare model.
And what we do is we provide the kind of infrastructure support to Army medicine, Navy medicine, and Air Force medicine so that they can deliver the health care and the health services to all of their beneficiaries.
The Defense Department used to provide health care for millions of service members and their families in separate silos. The Army had its own health care, so did the Navy, and so did the Air Force. But beginning in 2011, the military began streamlining.
So instead of having like three heads of pharmacy, we would just have one.
Bono took over last November, just a month after the reorganization process was complete. Now, her agency is getting ready to roll out an electronic records system. They're also trying to take lessons learned from the last 15 years of combat overseas, where the military dramatically improved trauma care.
The piece that came out of that was that it was not a singular or a series of singular episodes of care. It had to be holistic. You know, we had to include the family members. And that model, we're realizing, is what we want to be able to provide in all of our healthcare services.
Bono came to Alaska to see how the bases here are delivering care and whether there are problems on the ground that she and her staff might not be aware of at their offices back in Virginia. In some ways, Alaska and its bases are ahead of the curve. The Army and Air Force have collaborated for years at their joint base in Anchorage. Veterans can get treatment at the hospital here on base, even though that'd normally be reserved for folks that are still active duty. Those are the kinds of integration the DHA is looking to replicate. But this isn't the sort of nimble, large-scale innovation that the military is known for.
We were so accustomed to kind of doing things in the same way over and over again, and to find a solution that's sustainable will really require us to think differently.
The sustainability piece is huge. DHA's budget request for the next fiscal year is $33.5 billion. Bono says that spending level is buying taxpayers a healthcare system that's increasingly designed around the needs of service members rather than asking them to design their lives around it. The prospect of overhauling two of the densest bureaucracies in the country, healthcare and the military, sounds daunting. But when I ask Bono if she likes her job, I get a surprise.
I love it because, sorry.
That's okay.
I really believe that the people who serve in uniform and the families who make sure that those of us in uniform can serve deserve to be at the top of their game all the time.
And doing that, Bono says, means having a healthcare system that can meet everyone's needs. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, embracing traditional Alaska Native spirituality.
When you're 5 years old and you can touch a person's hand and see what they did for the last 3 days, and you tell them about it, man, that's scary to them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you've earned some college credits but haven't yet completed your degree, finish it now, online from anywhere. Online learning at University of Alaska Southeast provides courses in a format that is flexible for students working and raising families. Admission deadlines have been extended to August 19th. Apply now. Go to finishcollege.alaska.edu for more information. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
As we speak, The luxury liner Crystal Serenity is leaving Unalaska on the next leg of its trip from Seward to New York City through the Northwest Passage. It's the largest cruise ship to navigate the route, which hugs the coasts of Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. And it's attracted international attention, with many wondering if it's a sign of what's to come as the Arctic sees increasingly ice-free summers. Rachel Waldholtz of Alaska's Energy Desk reports.
The Crystal Serenity has 13 decks, 8 restaurants, a casino, and a spa. Staterooms for this trip start at about $20,000 and run as high as $120,000. Sitting in her room, passenger Moira Summers says for most of the people on board, the ship is as much of a destination as the Arctic.
When you start your cruise, no matter where in the world you are, and you get on the ship and you see the ship, it's goosebump stuff. I personally get goosebumps.
Summers and her husband live in Victoria, BC. She's originally from Namibia. Like the majority of people on board, they're repeat cruisers. She says this is perhaps her 16th trip with Crystal. But this time is a little bit different.
Maybe we're not so sure what we're letting ourselves in for. But there's so much we've read, so much we've prepared ourselves, and we know it's a big thing.
Smaller cruise ships have visited the region for years, but the Crystal Serenity, with more than 1,600 guests and crew, is the largest passenger ship to traverse the full winding Northwest Passage through the top of Canada. It's a dry run for large-scale tourism in a region that hasn't seen anything of its kind before. And the man in charge is not worried.
I am Captain Birger Vorland, the master of Crystal Serenity.
Vorland has 38 years at sea. Originally from Norway, he says the Northwest Passage has special resonance.
My countryman, Roald Amundsen, did the first transit here between 1903 and 1906. He spent 3 years on this passage. We're going to do it in 32 days and in a lot more comfort.
Standing on the navigation deck, Vorland ticks off the special preparations. Systems to detect ice, 2 Canadian ice pilots joining him in Nome, an escort ship in case it runs into trouble.
We crossed all the T's, dotted all the I's. Nobody has ever planned a cruise as diligently and as detailed as Crystal Cruises have done for this particular voyage.
Our crew members will now demonstrate the correct way to put on your life jacket. Guest helpers, prepare for life jacket demonstration.
As the ship gets ready to leave Seward, passengers participate in an emergency drill. In the casino, guests wearing life jackets gather around staff holding signs that read, Lifeboat 6. And despite Vorland's assurances, plenty of people are worried about what happens if this scenario plays out in real life. Elena Agarkova tracks shipping for the World Wildlife Fund, a conservation group.
There's absolutely no capacity to respond to accidents.
There's very little search and rescue infrastructure in the Arctic. That's a major concern for authorities. On August 24th, just as the Crystal Serenity is passing through the region, the Coast Guard and U.S. military are staging a major training exercise, which will simulate a cruise ship going down in the Bering Strait. And the question isn't just, is the Crystal Serenity ready for the Arctic, but is the Arctic ready for the Crystal Serenity? Some of the communities it's visiting in Canada have populations smaller than the ship itself. Agarkova with the World Wildlife Fund says Crystal has done a good job of working with communities and addressing environmental concerns, but she says there's no guarantee those precautions will be taken in the future.
They're doing these measures voluntarily, so there's nothing that would require, cruise lines or cruise ships that would follow in their steps to adhere to the same kinds of standards.
And Agarkova points out the irony of this new era, when the very changes making the region accessible are also transforming it. That's not lost on passenger Moira Summers.
One kind of feels, I won't say guilty, but you're taking advantage of what is happening.
She says she hopes the cruise is raising awareness of climate change. As for her more immediate goals?
My big dream is to see a polar bear. Yeah, and just being able to have a successful trip, I think, getting through and with no hiccups, etc.
Getting through with no hiccups. That's what a lot of people are rooting for as the Crystal Serenity cruises towards the Arctic. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
T Two men suspected of robbing an Anchorage bank were arrested early this morning at the city's main airport. The FBI says airport police recognized 23-year-old Kaleem Fredericks and 23-year-old Khalil Crawford from pictures released by the FBI. Airport police held the men shortly after midnight, and they were arrested by FBI agents. On Thursday morning, two men, one carrying a shotgun and one with a handgun, robbed a Wells Fargo branch on East 5th Avenue. They carried off cash in a duffel bag. Fredericks and Crawford are in custody, awaiting their first court appearance. Denali National Park is testing two new hybrid buses. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the vehicles are the final prototypes to be tested by the Park Service at Denali as part of a grant-funded effort to reduce pollution.
The new 14 and 32-passenger shuttles are manufactured by Colorado-based Lightning Hybrids. Company spokeswoman Bonnie Trowbridge says just like hybrid electric vehicles, the buses employ a system that captures braking energy.
It's the same thing, only we're not using batteries. We're using pressure.
Trowbridge says the buses use braking to pressurize hydraulic fluid.
And then when you accelerate, all that pressure is available and used to move that vehicle forward.
Trowbridge says the diesel engine only operates above 40 miles per hour when it's most efficient. The new Denali buses are the latest funded by a grant to test hybrid technology on the park road. Denali National Park Commercial Services Specialist Andrew Gertsch says two previously tested school bus-sized hybrid electric vehicles proved less efficient, quiet, and durable than hoped.
That was expected, to be honest, but we really wanted to test that to prove, just to document, where the technology is now and why it's not working. The silt, the really fine dirt on the park road just really wreaked havoc.
Gertsch says the agency has changed its focus to the smaller shuttles employing the hydraulic system and testing them on short routes along the paved front country section of the park road.
The more the vehicle stops, the more fuel economy it has. So the two buses were integrated into the Riley Creek campground loop and the Savage Loop.
Regular park buses are monochrome painted school buses, but the new shuttles feature full color wildlife imagery wrapping.
Because it is in the era of the National Park Service Centennial, and we have our Denali Park Centennial next year, we decided to use some remaining funds to hire an advertising agency to give some messaging to the exterior of these buses.
Gertsch says the hybrid bus technology has potential beyond the park as local mass transit options are considered along the park's highway between Healy and Cantwell. He also notes that park concessioner Doyon Aramark brought 10 cleaner operating propane-fired buses online this summer. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbaalaska.com.
The University of Alaska Southeast School of Management offers online college degrees for the unconventional student or working professional who wants learning on their schedule and timeline. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugiak,
Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Aleknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Knowing the Unknown. Since Russian priests began establishing missions at the end of the 18th century, the Orthodox Church has become part of the landscape of Southwest Alaska. What's less visible today than Orthodox crosses and golden cupolas are the Alaska Native belief systems that existed before European contact. KDLG's Hannah Colton has this story about one man who came to embrace his traditional spirituality and why he's choosing now to speak up about it.
Larry Hill hesitates to call himself a shaman, but he is open about the fact that he often and inexplicably knows things that seem unknowable. We'll get back to that. For now, Hill is on the shore of Lake Clark in Southwest Alaska, speaking to about a dozen kids from Nundalton. He pulls a flat, polished rock from his pocket.
So today, what I'd like you to do is
find yourself a couple of stones. This is an example here.
We're at Adena Inna Culture Camp, like this, and Hill is one of a handful of elders who've come to share their knowledge with the youth. This afternoon's lesson is on something called worry stones.
It's called a worry stone. Some of you may have heard that word before. There's a Adena Inna word for it, and I don't know what it is.
The idea, Hill explains, is that you can program the stone with happy, positive thoughts and use it when you're stressed or sad. It's based on a Adena Inna belief that everything in nature has some kind of energy.
Now, it's your choice whether you want to believe what I'm saying or not. That's up to you. Some people look upon this as, and I'll say the word, superstition. But to me, it's very real.
The kids fan out across the beach to pick their own stones.
The colors on that one are really cool.
Yeah.
Now, this idea that all things are connected through their energies, Hale learned it from his grandmother as a young boy in the village of Nundalton in the 40s and 50s. Back then, he says, he didn't understand much about spirituality. But already, he had an ability to know and see things that other people couldn't.
When you're 5 years old and you can touch a person's hand and see what they did for the last 3 days, and you tell them about it, man, that's scary to them.
It wasn't scary to Hill's closest relatives. Their family lore counts shamans and seers going back generations on both his mother's Adena Inna side and his father's side in Finland. But it definitely freaked other people out.
And in the village, I got picked on sometimes and beat up because I would always know the answer to those questions.
So, like a lot of kids who don't fit in, Hill learned to hide who he was. He grew up shy, and by the time he was 20, he was spending a lot of time by himself up in the hills. Then in 1967, he joined the army and was sent to Korea. He found that his test scores were good, so he was pushed into schools and leadership roles.
I was able to do those things, and it gave me a lot more confidence in myself.
Hill also experienced things in the army that he doesn't like to talk about now. After he got out, he says he started drinking to cope with the bad memories and to drown out the voices in his head. When he eventually sobered up, the voices were still there. So he stopped fighting it.
About 20 years ago, there was a death in an unnamed village. And that night, I received a message from that person. And I could not rest until I delivered that message.
Hill says he'd often have an answer to some unresolved question between the deceased and their loved one. In many cases, he says his message brought comfort to the bereaved. But other times, he was met with disbelief or anger. He says he's even been assaulted for it. And he's gotten pushback from another spiritual body, the Russian Orthodox community. Hill was baptized in the church. He considers himself a believer. But some of the local ministers, he says, do not like him bringing people these divinely inspired messages.
And some of these priests were family friends, and they haven't spoken to me since one occasion. But again, I accept that. I know that that's part of it.
Hill has accepted the messiness that comes with living out his beliefs. But these kids at camp, they're just starting out, and it's a lot to swallow.
The worry rock, I kind of believe in it.
That's Nolan Schaefer, Hill's grandson. He's 16, smart, and serious, and he's talked with his grandpa a lot about his spirituality. After the worry stone lesson, I asked him how he feels about these messages or voices his grandpa gets, and the fact that they seem to run in the family.
If that happened to me, I'd feel really weirded out, but I'd love it, because having a vision of something good or bad, it would be pretty cool to actually have.
The worry stone is just one little piece of Adena Inna spirituality, one that Schaefer and the other kids can hold in their hands. It's a tiny window into a worldview that they're not being taught in school or at church. And Larry Hill hopes they'll understand someday when they're old enough to need it. For AK, I'm Hannah Colton.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Omega Smith, who manages the UAA Planetarium in Anchorage.
I was born in Anchorage, Alaska, grew up on Hillside, graduated from Service High.
And then I went away for a little bit to get my degree, but I've always had to come back. This is definitely my home. I've always liked astronomy. I think every kid loves astronomy. But it was more like the big unknown, and when I found out more about astronomy, I actually went to UAA for a couple years before I went to get my degree, and I took the astronomy classes, and I realized that the more you learn about astronomy, the more we realize we don't know. It's extremely humbling. It's a lot of fun all the time. I mean, I think one of the biggest thrills is that nerddom has become such a pop culture right now. So people are really interested in coming. We have a lot of people come all the time, and people are just genuinely interested in what you have to say. So it's not like teaching a class of students. You get people who come specifically to hear what you have to talk about and to know more about what you're an expert on. So there's kind of a reason why there's no observatories up here. One, it's always light out in the summertime. So whenever it's warm enough to really spend the whole entire night out, you can't see any stars, except for the sun. And in the wintertime, even though we have really long night skies, there is usually a lot of clouds. And even though the aurora is absolutely beautiful, it does kind of block a lot of the stars. If you actually want to see stars and everything, I suggest the end of August, September, where it's still warm enough to go outside and you still get nice dark skies. But if you want to view things like the aurora, for some reason that astronomers still don't know, aurora are always very active during the equinoxes. So the March equinox is probably the best one. It's going to be colder than the September equinox, but you can really see some good aurora then.
Omega Smith lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Hannah Colton and Ammon Swenson. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Zachariah Hughes and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
If you've earned some college credits but haven't yet completed your degree, finish it now, online from anywhere. Online learning at University of Alaska Southeast provides courses in a format that is flexible for students working and raising families. Admission deadlines have been extended to August 19th. Apply now. Go to finishcollege.alaska.edu for more information. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.